Judge Cochran, Judge Hooten, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
You may be seated. Thank you. The next case on the calendar today is A18-1287 in the matter of Cindy Ali. Each side will have 15 minutes for oral argument, and the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If counsel can please introduce themselves and state who you're representing here today, I'd appreciate it. So you can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Christopher Scott with Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, here on behalf of the appellant, Cindy Ali. Your Honors, this case is about the Scott County CDA unilaterally deciding that a mother cannot care for her severely developmentally disabled child without losing
her
Section
8. Well, is that really the issue? I mean, well, go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor, that is the issue here because she's attempting to care for her child, and there's income at issue, and that income being calculated into the household calculation is ultimately ruling her ineligible for the Section 8 program. So by not being able to care for her child, she's essentially having to choose between care for her child or risk her Section 8. If she cares for her child, she's lost her Section 8.
But what about someone who actually works outside the home and just hires someone? I mean, that person's income would be considered. Why does she get an advantage that another person who works outside of the home would not get?
Your Honor, and I believe that that's essentially the CDA's argument here. This is a plain language regulation, and it's very clear that it's specifically for individuals who suffer from developmental disabilities. As you, I'm sure, have seen in the briefs, the Riley opinion that's been cited dealt with that same issue. Individuals basically who don't suffer from developmental disabilities aren't receiving the same type of benefit. But again, I think the plain language argument shows that this is a specific exclusion for those who suffer from developmental disabilities.
So what is the cost when she's providing care for her child? Because the language at issue allows the exclusion of amounts paid by a state agency to a family with a member who has a developmental disability and is living at home to offset the cost of services and equipment needed to keep the developmentally disabled family member at home. So when she's caring for her own child, what is the cost?
I believe the cost here is an opportunity cost. The CDA's contention is that there has to be some sort of monetary expense incurred. I don't believe that falls in line with the ultimate purpose of the regulation and the program in which the family is involved with.
Right, but we look at the statute in plain language to determine what the intent is. It sounds like what you're getting into is a little bit more of the also policy issues, but do we even need to get to that point?
I do believe we need to look at the ultimate purpose, the overarching purpose of the program. And there are two definitions of the word cost. There is the idea of incurring a monetary expense, but there is also the idea of the opportunity cost, for instance, not being able to go out and seek outside employment. There's also the societal cost of institutionalization within the state of a developmentally disabled individual.
I just want to go to the, you were talking about the plain language, and I'm looking at the plain language says amounts paid by a state agency to a family with a member who has a developmental disability and is living at home, and I think at least the words that are emphasized by the respondent here is to offset the cost of services and equipment needed to keep the developmentally disabled family member at home, which it basically is someone paying for it.
Well, again, Your Honor, I believe that that's one interpretation of the idea of cost. I think the other idea is that there's an opportunity cost. She cannot seek outside employment.
Right, but if you look at the plain language, it says to offset the cost of services and equipment. It doesn't say to offset the cost of services and equipment and then further define costs as and to include opportunity costs or any allusion to opportunity costs. It just specifies the cost of services and equipment. So it's very specific.
Correct. And so they're not adding that language to identify exactly what type of costs. I believe that when you look at, for instance, the rulemaking record from the Riley case, they explained that there's no real, the emphasis isn't on the idea of cost. The emphasis is on the idea of keeping this person housed, keeping this person within the home and avoiding institutionalization.
But right. Isn't the Riley decision consistent with keeping the person in the home, which is certainly a good purpose? But under the Riley decision, it recognizes that whether the parent works outside of the home or in the home, the result is the same, and the developmentally disabled family members able to stay in the home under the Riley's decision's interpretation of the rule.
I think the Riley's interpretation very narrowly defined this regulation, which again goes against the purpose of keeping these people in the home. In the Riley opinion, they focus on the idea of offsetting a cost, I believe, because they wanted to develop some sort of parity between developmentally disabled individuals and, for instance, physically disabled individuals. But this regulation goes directly towards developmentally disabled individuals. So to get into such a nuanced analysis of the idea of offsetting a cost really undermines the ultimate goal and purpose of the program that my client's involved with, as well as the regulation.
Well, let's assume you had a parent who worked outside the home and instead paid someone to provide care so that the family member could stay in the home and use that same money to provide care. That expense would be excluded, right?
Correct,
but then
under
the parent's
CDA's
income would be included.
Correct.
And so doesn't this treatment of your client basically put your client and a parent who works outside the home on equal footing in terms of this is really income to her to be able to keep her child in the home? This is income that she's earning.
Well, I think to sort of answer the first part of your question, that's a choice that a family gets to make if they're dealing with a developmentally disabled individual. They can go outside and work and have that income be included, or they can follow a program such as the Consumer Directed
Program.
But
if this money is excluded in your client's situation, the person who works outside the home would be in a worse position financially than someone who stays in the home, correct?
Yes, I would concede that they would be, if they were in the same exact position, they would be in the, they would, that income would be included versus excluded, but I believe that, again,
so those
is
two
family's
parents,
choice.
Those two parents would be treated differently. And what would be the purpose behind that in having a disparate treatment for those two parents when, in both situations, the goal of keeping the family member in the home would be accomplished?
Well, I think that disparate treatment would be forwarded by the family's choice, not necessarily by the regulation itself. I don't believe that the regulation would be creating that disparate impact. I think the person could participate in the same type of program and receive the same exact benefit.
You know, in another part of the regulation in C4, it also references the word, or uses the word cost, and it talks about, it's another exclusion, amounts received by the family that are specifically for or in reimbursement of the cost of medical expenses for any family member. So, and generally, when words are used in different places in the same regulation, they're given the same meaning. So to be consistent, wouldn't it make sense that the word cost in 16 also refers to a financial cost, as it does in 4?
I think you can see that in C4, but I think you can also see something that's similar in C2, that would fall in line with my interpretation of the regulation as it relates to foster care. That is income that otherwise looks like income, but these exclusions are specifically enumerated to attack those things that otherwise look like income and need to be excluded for the societal or policy purposes of that particular exclusion. We ultimately want to keep foster children in the home. And so these people getting paid for providing foster care, that would look like something that should be included, but it's excluded for the policy purpose. I think that falls directly in line with what we're arguing here under C16 in terms of keeping developmentally disabled individuals housed.
Although that C2 refers to payments and doesn't include the word costs, whereas 16 talks about amounts paid to offset costs, cost of services and equipment.
Well, I would argue that they're essentially getting to the same idea of incurring an expense.
Okay, thank you.
But the statute still, I'm still looking at the plain language, and I'm trying to find some language here that would support your argument in C16 as to having a family member be the caretaker that gets paid and then being treated differently than a parent who works outside of the home. That inconsistency, well, first of all, it's an inconsistency there, how you're treating the parents, but more importantly, looking at the statute, I don't see how it's designed to cover a parent.
Mm-hmm. Well,
because you could still have a parent who works outside the home can still hire somebody to take care of the family member with a disability and have those costs paid. Mm-hmm. So isn't really that the purpose based on the plain language of the statute?
I certainly understand that reasoning, and again, I don't believe that we have to focus on the idea of offsetting a cost. I believe HUD, essentially, in the Riley case in the rulemaking record, stated that, okay, even if this is ambiguous here, this is an issue where we want to encourage people from avoiding institutionalization. The rulemaking record basically states, since families that strive to avoid institutionalization should be encouraged and not punished, the department is adding this additional exclusion to income. It further went on to state that if the family is receiving such a payment from the state because a family member meets the criteria of the definition of developmentally disabled, the housing authority should consider the family eligible for the exclusion. So in the nuanced analysis of whether you're offsetting a cost, I believe, was very secondary to HUD's ultimate purpose of creating this exclusion. Again, we ultimately want to keep these people housed. So offsetting a cost, whether it be a parent-allocated portion who's providing services in the home versus that parent being outside working, I think was very secondary. Also, combined with the fact that the CDCS program wants to provide the family flexibility to be able to care for the disabled family members' needs the best that they can and ensure their continued development. I believe that essentially, you know, HUD didn't want to be as worried about how the costs were being reimbursed or expensed or incurred, but ultimately we wanted to keep them in the home.
Well, isn't the fact that there is even a provision that allows for the payment of wages to a parent, doesn't that accomplish that purpose? Isn't that enough to keep them in the home? I mean, if a parent gets wages either staying at home with their child or working outside the home, isn't that enough in and of itself to keep them at home with their child?
Not in this particular situation as it relates to the Section 8 program, because as soon as that money is included under the CDCS program, Ms. Ali became ineligible for the Section 8 program. I'm sorry. So essentially,
because she was
as soon
over
as,
the income limit?
I'm sorry?
Because she was over the income
correct,
limit?
Correct. Correct. This portion that she was allocated to herself, once that portion was included, she was over the income guidelines, and she then became ineligible, which poses the risk of not keeping this person housed.
But, I mean, is this going to cause her to hire somebody else so to come into the home, so she can work outside the home? I mean...
That's essentially what the CDA is saying she has to do. She has to hire other people outside the home in order to remain eligible. I think that...
Why would she do that if she can actually get an income and take care of her child at the same time?
Well, I think, again, that goes to the purpose of a mother should be able to care for her child. She shouldn't have to search for several PCAs. Sometimes we don't necessarily know exactly how good these PCAs are. You're shifting several PCAs throughout a disabled person's life. I would argue, and I think it's fairly understandable, that a mother is in the best position to care for her child, and if she elects to do that under a program like this, she should have the ability to do that and not suffer the consequences of losing her housing in return. Your Honor, I see that my time is getting close to up, so with that, I would ask the court to reverse the hearing officer's decision and reinstate my client's Section 8 assistance. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Robert Elsop. I represent the Scott County Community Development Agency, the respondent in this action. We're here today to ask the court to affirm the CDA's decision not to exclude income that Ms. Ali received from the state of Minnesota with regard to in the calculation of her rent in her Section 8 voucher program with the CDA. This matter is before the court on a writ of cert, appropriately appealed and before the court and briefed. The facts are not complicated. I'm not going to review them for you unless you have any specific questions, other than to indicate to the court and remind the court that it is the CDA's responsibility to comply with and implement the federal regulations to the best of their ability, and that's exactly what they were doing here.
Well, is it the intent of the federal HUD regulation to preclude Ms. Ali from obtaining Section 8 housing?
Pardon me? I'm sorry.
Relator's counsel was arguing that the effect of this interpretation would preclude Ms. Ali from obtaining Section 8 housing. Is your interpretation consistent with the purposes of these two governmental programs?
Well, Your Honor, I was going to preface my argument today by applauding what the CDCS program does. It does, it's a great benefit, it's a great program. It provides resources, it provides wages, it provides training, all these things for people so they can have their disabled children stay within the home or other family members stay within the home. It is not the intent of the CDA to interfere with this or impact this in any way. It's two separate programs. And the fact that the regulation has an impact on that program is not, it's unfortunate, but we are bound by the regulations. And the regulations do require an income-based analysis as to who qualifies, and anyone who were to go out, any current Section 8 person who were to go out and get a job and got too much income would be disqualified. That's what the regs provide. And in this situation, I don't think the intent is to make people disqualified, but the intent is to provide some kind of objective standard in determining income and how that's going to be implemented by the public housing authorities across the nation. So to answer your question, that is not the intent to interfere with this program. The intent is to comply with the regulations that are applicable in this situation.
Right, but isn't part of the purpose of this program, I mean, it does talk about how the goal really is to keep the person with a disability at home. And what better person to take care of a person with a disability at home than a parent?
Well, which program are you talking about? Are you talking about the Section 8 program, or are you talking about the CDC?
I'm talking about the CDC in terms of the C-16, interpreting the C-16 statute.
In interpreting it, the Congress clearly identified what they considered to be appropriate expenses that should not be included in the income. I don't think they had any indication as to parents being paid. It's not written that way. It could have easily been written that way to include these payments. It was not written that way, and that's where we go back to the plain language of the regulation.
Right, but even if we look at the plain language of the regulation, we want to avoid an absurd result. And here...
I'm sorry, absurd result in what way?
An absurd result in the sense that you in effect are punishing a parent for wanting to stay home to take care of their child with a disability, because they by having that considered their income, they're going to lose Section 8 housing, and they're not going to be able to take care of their child. I mean, yes, you could hire somebody, but who's better qualified to take care of a child than a parent?
Well, again, I would argue to the court that that's a policy decision for HUD and the people who made the regulation.
I understand that, but what about the fact that if an interpretation of a regulation leads to an absurd result, that's not something that is a way that the statute can be overturned and not followed.
I guess I'm a little concerned about what the absurd result is. I'm not tracking that, because the fact that someone loses their housing because income exceeds the limits established by the regs happens all the time. It's not absurd. I guess the absurdity that you're referring to is the fact that they allow for an exclusion from income for costs and expenses for people to get developmental resources in the house, but don't identify potential wages so the parent can stay there. That's our argument, that's the way it's written. And whether it's absurd or right is not the question for the court. The court is I don't think it's absurd, it's the intent of the Congress when they pass this law.
Well, but that's one of the canons of construction that we look at. We do look at the plain language, but if the result obtained from a plain reading language leads to an absurd result, then the statute won't stand.
Okay. Well, I would argue that the decisions in the Riley case and the Anthony case, which are cited in our decision, stress a number of things for this court to consider. Number one, I go back to the plain language. You have to give meaning to each of the words in the regulation. And it does refer to a cost, and it does refer to an offset. And what is the offset that's being done here in terms of that would qualify it for a cost that's being offset?
What about the opportunity cost of...
And the Riley court specifically addressed that issue in terms of the opportunity cost. That's clearly not intended here. They could have written that into the... And I'm not saying they used the word opportunity cost, but they could have said any costs received from a program like this, any cost or any payment from a program like this that is intended to keep developmentally disabled people in the home should not be income. That's not what the regulation says.
So is it your position that this is unambiguous?
I'm sorry?
Is it your position that the statute is unambiguous?
That would be my argument, yes. Yes, it is unambiguous. And just to touch on the point made by counsel for the appellant, the rulemaking provisions are not helpful here in terms of the position that's being articulated by the appellant. What that rule interpretation says is that they were deciding whether to define developmentally disabled, and rather than go down that road, they simply said if you qualify for the state program, you meet the second element of the regulation, which is there's a developmentally disabled member of the family. That's the extent of that rule record that is referenced by counsel for the appellant. It does not stand for the proposition, which is the third element, as to the cost and the offset and what qualifies for those costs. The rulemaking doesn't help. The plain language part of it, as Judge Cochran pointed out, you try to treat words the same. And the word cost is used other places in the regulation and clearly don't apply to the costs anticipated or argued by the appellant with regard to wages. That's not what the cost refers to. Finally, as we indicate in our brief, I think there should be some deference given to HUD's interpretation of this regulation. Although we say it's plain and unambiguous to the extent this court deems it to be ambiguous, I think it's helpful that the court look to the interpretation and recommendations by HUD staff. Both here in the state of Minnesota and in the Anthony case, they had an opinion letter as well that was provided that is consistent with this interpretation.
Didn't the court find that unpersuasive in the Riley case?
Actually, the Riley decision held that you should not consider that, not because it's not persuasive, but because it was a litigation-based opinion.
That's correct. I'm sorry.
But I would argue it's the position of the HUD that's been articulated here locally and nationally, and should be to the extent you consider the regulation to be ambiguous somehow. I think HUD's interpretation should be given great deference, and the cases cited in the Anthony case support that argument.
So when you're talking about the HUD's interpretation provided in this case, what exactly are you referring to? Are you referring to the discussion with Mr. Santana?
No, no. Mr. Santana was with the CDCS.
Oh, that's right.
CDCS.
You're right. I'm sorry.
It's actually emails attached to our record with the local HUD office. 013 through 023. These are emails that were exchanged not only between our HUD, the CDA office and the local regional HUD office, but also counsel for the appellant in the local HUD office. So I wouldn't call it an anticipation of litigation. I would call it guidance and help and consideration of what HUD considers to be the appropriate interpretation. And their conclusion was that the payments of income to Ms. Ali should not be excluded under this applicable regulation. It should be noted to the court that other expenses made or paid to Ms. Ali for training and resources and other things were excluded from her income. And this argument that we are keeping her from allowing the child to stay in the house, I think, is a little bit over the top, in the sense that she clearly has the opportunity to use her money that she received as income to hire some third party to come in and take care of her child.
I have page 13 here. That was before the hearing in this matter, correct? That was,
I think, one of them
in
was
July 2017 by Julie Stakoff.
Yeah. There might have been some emails afterwards, too, in terms of there was this request for reconsideration. We might have gone back one more time to make sure that we're on the right page.
Okay. I want to talk briefly about the due process argument. I think it is concerning that the hearing officer contacted Mr. Santana after the hearing was over, but I'm not sure there's any prejudice that resulted. Can you speak to that?
A couple things with regard to that, Your Honor. Number one, the formal rules of evidence don't apply. The extent of due process that should be granted in this situation is a circumstance. You know, it's not your typical high-test due process. It's the ability to present evidence and be heard by the appropriate authority. Our argument is that has been done in this case. The fact that the hearing officer reached out and tried to clarify some of the information provided by the hearing does not violate any due process rights. And I would argue to the court that the request for reconsideration is almost like a redo. And counsel for the appellant clearly articulated all the arguments they wanted to in their letter for reconsideration, which is part of this record that you're going to look at. And the CDA did look at not only the due process issue again, or the due process issue for the first time, but also the merits of the regulation, and went back and looked at her file again to confirm what the employee from CDCS had already told the hearing officer, is that this was taxable income with deductions, and that's why the hearing officer reached out to that employee. Again, no prejudice, and when offered the opportunity to identify you know, what cross-examination or what additional information or what contrary evidence the appellant had to contradict what Mr. Santana had provided to the hearing officer, there was nothing. So to the extent there's a due process claim, we would argue it doesn't rise to the level of a constitutional due process. It was a glitch in the hearing process with no prejudice to the appellant. With that, I would ask that the decision of the CDA be affirmed. and the due process claim denied.
Thank you. The relator will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, I'd like to address the due process issue. It is understood that the rules of evidence are relaxed in these sorts of administrative hearing issues. However, Mr. Santana was not present at the hearing. It's clear from the hearing officer's decision that his intimation that these are taxable wages influenced her decision to include this as income. The idea of taxability is irrelevant when it comes to this HUD regulation. There's several other instances where money may be taxable, but because it has a specific purpose to be excluded, it's excluded.
Are you denying the amount that was given or the fact that it was received as wages? Is there any dispute?
Again, the whole idea is these things look like income. So even if it is, quote unquote, income and it's taxable, if it's excluded under a particular exclusion, then the taxability doesn't matter. So I believe with the idea that if Mr. Santana would have been at the hearing and would have, and the hearing officer would have heard that the taxability doesn't matter, that would have potentially affected the hearing officer's decision.
In our analysis of the issue, though, we're analyzing the plain language of the statute. So if we don't rely on the information that Mr. Santana provided in any way, is there a due process concern? Does the due process concern still exist?
If the court doesn't rely on any information that Mr. Santana provided, then no, there wouldn't be a due process violation. We would be heavily focused, and the case is heavily focused on the language of the regulation, certainly.
But I just want to understand your prejudice argument. You're not arguing about the underlying facts. You're just arguing about the law as to whether the wages, the fact they were taxable, has any relevance here?
Correct. The taxability, again, it doesn't matter. But it appears from the hearing officer's decision that it essentially was a nail in the coffin on the hearing officer deciding whether or not it was income.
But you're not denying it was paid as wages, that was the number?
No, we're not denying that it was paid as wages, just that even if it is paid as wages, it's excluded under this particular exclusion. I would also like to emphasize for the court that the Riley opinion is certainly heavily cited here in these briefs, and we're looking to it to kind of understand how the court understood this regulation, but it is being appealed in California, and so its persuasive authority is relatively low at this point.
Even if it's being appealed, though, it is the law in California as of this moment.
As it currently stands, yes, but I believe that the acceptance of the petition on appeal shows that the reasoning behind interpreting the regulation is questionable.
Well, I'm not so sure that's true. I mean, that happens all the time with us, where our decisions get appealed, and nobody knows whether it's going to be affirmed, reversed, affirmed in part. So I don't know if we can really read into the tea leaves as to why the California Supreme Court took it up on appeal.
Understood, Your Honor. I believe that the issue, though, is whether or not this is offsetting some sort of cost, because that is what the Riley opinion was dealing with. And I believe that, again, that the Riley opinion in the Court of Appeals there narrowly construed it to the point where it became an issue of whether or not this is income that should be excluded or included. Again, with my argument is that the overarching purpose is what we should be looking at rather than that narrow interpretation, which, again, I believe was really getting to the idea of trying to not give some sort of windfall to developmentally disabled individuals compared to, again, physically disabled individuals.
Do you think the statute is ambiguous, or do you just think we should look at the plain meaning? Do you think it's clear from the plain meaning?
I believe it's clear from the plain meaning. I can understand why the idea of cost would be, or offsetting a cost would be ambiguous, and that's why I believe the rulemaking record comes into play to show that the ultimate purpose is to see whether this is a state agency that's defined someone as developmentally disabled. And if that has happened, then the regulation applies to any income associated with that disability.
You have 10 seconds. Do you know what the status of the Riley case is? I mean, I know they accepted cert, but do you know how far along they are?
I'm unsure on that. I don't believe it's been heard yet in terms of argument.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much. That was well argued. We will issue our decision within the 90-day statutory time period.